Today's program is brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com.
I'm Erica Wides, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good afternoon and welcome. This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and I am just delighted to welcome today a very special guest. She happens to be a listener, and we have been corresponding for several years now, although somewhat sporadically. Her name is Dr. Flora Josephine Hagen-Lister. And she is the District Veterinary Officer of Western Iceland in the Icelandic Food and Veterinary Authority. Her work includes monitoring food safety, animal health, and animal welfare. She inspects food animal production facilities and food business operations. It is really my great good fortune to have her as a listener, and I'm so delighted that she has consented to join me on the show to offer a more global perspective on food animal production. So welcome to the program, Josie. It is really an honor to have you. I'm so excited about this.
Well, likewise, Katie, it's a great honor to be on your show. I've been looking forward to this.
Oh, totally, babes. So, and I hope you'll be a guest again some other time when we have more, you know, sort of global things to talk about. But why don't we start by just talking about what your job is? Because you have quite a complex job compared to sort of the ordinary vet here in the United States.
Well, my job is primarily inspecting. So what I do is I go to farms and where I will be inspecting for animal welfare regulations and food safety regulations. And I'll just be looking at the farm and seeing whether I find any non-compliances. And after that, I write up a report and I give them a deadline to be compliant. Uh-huh. And I also go to food business operators, where I will be, of course, only inspecting for food hygiene. And
right.
In my district, it's primarily dairies, and I also have a meat cutting plant for fin whales.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know if we could go to we'll do another show about whales. Because, I mean, that's like a dirty word in this country. Cutting whales? You're not allowed to eat whale meat in the United States. There's no such whale business.
I know it's quite controversial, but
yeah.
There you have it.
Well, you aren't actually Icelandic by birth, so you can kind of like, you know, say this without any, you know, whatever. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
You don't have to defend the practice. It just exists.
Yes, exactly. Well, it's controversial here. Icelandic people it's a small nation, and they're usually very proud of whatever they do, and they don't want any big guys to tell them what to do. So traditionally, just because somebody's telling them not to do it, they want to do it.
Wow.
But you know, it's becoming a little more controversial. But that's a different discussion.
What kind of whales are they? Just did you say fin whales?
Fin whale. Well, they hunt two types of whales here. It's fin whales and a smaller type, which on the top of my mind I cannot remember the English name of it.
Okay.
But fin whale is the second largest whale in the world.
Wow.
So, yeah.
So that's really very naughty indeed. I'm sure it's a very endangered species.
Well, the Icelanders don't think they're naughty, but
yes.
So, yeah.
That's okay. All right. Well, as you say, it'll be another show. But tell us a little bit about Icelandic livestock agriculture. Like, how big are the farms or the facilities that you visit? How many head are aggregated typically?
This is such a tiny country, so they are a lot smaller than anything you'll find in the U.S. When it comes to dairy farms, the average size is like 37 cows.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I know. So it varies from like 10 to 200.
Yeah.
And sheep farms, it's, you know, the biggest farms will be a little more than 1,000 heads per farm.
Uh-huh.
When it comes to poultry and pork or pig farms, they are sort of the same system as in the U.S., but just smaller scale. But you'll have the same houses with like 10,000 chickens in them and, uh-huh. and that kind of stuff. But maybe not, you know, 50 houses, but 10.
Right,
you
know. So right.
It's smaller scale, but same system.
So that's my next question. Your methods, at least let's concentrate on poultry and pork for the moment, because we can compare and contrast. So you told me that that swine operations in Iceland tend to have the same housing, meaning the confined area feeding operations, what we call them here, CAFOs. And they're on a slatted floor. Well, I think everybody does that now because, I mean, you don't want them mucking around in their own feces. I mean, that seems like the right thing to do.
To have them on slatted floors?
Yeah. As a vet, what do you feel about that? Is that a bad thing?
Well, of course, you don't want to have them mucking around in their own feces, but the problem with having them on, not that the floors are slatted, but having them without anything to root in, like, straw or something like that, is that they just get very bored and they don't have anything to do. I mean, they spend, I think, wild hogs or any kind of pig that you would set free would spend like 8 hours a day or something like that just rooting, and it's a very, very strong instinct. And mm-hmm. if they're just in a barren environment, they don't, you know, have anything to do.
Right, and that's when they get into biting each other's tails off and fighting and all that kind
of stuff. I sometimes compare, you know, like the way you keep cows sometimes in Thai stalls, in Thai barns. You know, in one way it would be comparable to keeping these sows in the gestation crates, but the cows spend so many hours a day eating, you know, they're chewing and chewing. So they have something to do, which the pigs don't.
Right.
Yeah.
So typically, in your experience of pork farms there, do they give them stuff to play with? Because I don't think we even do that. I don't think we even give them so much as a bale of hay to play with.
Yeah. Well, they do give them some toy things, plastic things and stuff like that. The regulation that is enforced now says that you're supposed to give them something. But it is a big challenge because all the farms are built, you know, with these slatted floors, and giving them a lot of straw or something to play with would clog their, their sewage system or their feces, you know.
Right. Sure.
Yeah. And so they can't just, you know, use their buildings that they have and throw in a whole lot of straw.
Right.
It is pretty new in the regulation, and they're, you know, still, this is a big problem actually in the whole of Europe, is this demand for so-called manipulable material, because of the strong need that pigs have to explore and root, and it's quite a challenge for the pig farms to find a way of doing it.
Yeah.
And handling all that straw or whatever it is. So a lot of places are experimenting with wood.
Uh-huh. That
giving
makes sense.
Them pieces of wood.
Yeah.
But they often get bored with them quite quickly.
Yeah.
This has been in the whole of Europe a demand in the regulation, and I know that it is a challenge to find manipulable materials.
Yes, I would imagine. I can see the problem, absolutely.
And just, you know, here in Iceland, we don't grow a lot of grain, so we don't have a lot of, you know, it's a luxury commodity, straw. Yeah. So there are a lot of challenges.
Yeah, I can
concerning
see that.
That.
Well, you sent me a very interesting article about tail docking, and we obviously tail dock here. I think it's completely acceptable. In the EU, it's now a regulation that you can't tail dock, at least without any anesthesia or anything. And I know that animal welfare groups are pushing for that in this country, but it is far from a done deal. I have never heard a regulation that animals have to have something to play with, ever. That has never crossed a pork farmer's mind in this country. I mean, if you pasture your pork, then they have something to do. But if you're running a pork house, you know, one of those big houses, they don't do that. No, it's not.
Are there even any? I once a few years ago tried to find on the internet a regulation, animal welfare regulation in the U.S., and I didn't find much of anything. Is there like a regulation in the U.S. for the welfare of pigs or something like that?
The regulations
that you're aware of?
The only regulations I'm aware of are sort of basic animal welfare, meaning like you're not allowed to strike an animal, you're not supposed to like stick an electric prod up its butt and stuff like that. But believe me, it happens all the time. I mean, there is no end to the undercover videos that surface, you know, from Mercy for Animals or PETA or some of the other animal welfare groups, which show that the workforce that works with our animals in this country is generally, very poorly paid, poorly trained, poorly supervised. And and there is a lot of animal abuse going on, even though, of course, the animal agriculture industry denies it to the death. I mean, they will just go. They will go to great. In fact, they're going to the lengths, including passing legislation, which I know you're aware of, that we call ag-gag in this country, where you could go to jail or be at the very least heavily fined for recording any of these abuses and then publishing them. So, it's really tough. But as far as a regulation like giving an animal something to do, no. And in poultry, which I know is another concern of yours. In poultry, they are the ASPCA, which is the biggest animal welfare organization in this country. It's the Association for Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. They are looking to pass legislation that would allow sort of natural behaviors in hens who most hens in this country are housed in very small cages where they literally can't turn around. You know, they don't even have a wingspan. And so they're trying to just, give them access to like roosting or pecking, things like that, because otherwise they pull out each other's feathers, which I know you are aware of.
Yeah.
But let's go on. So tell me, like, how does your job compare to, I think it's really interesting that you wear both hats in the sense that your job is comparable to a USDA inspector, meaning that you inspect the welfare of the animals, but also in our country, a USDA inspector is in a slaughter facility and makes sure that the meat is up to, the quality that we demand. So there's both an inspection and a welfare aspect to you as a vet and an inspector. And does that ever present conflicts of interest for you?
Welfare versus food hygiene? Is that what you're thinking about?
Well, yeah. I mean, I had a good example, which was like, supposing you see a farmer who is compliant with, the regulations as they are written, and yet you as a vet are concerned that this animal is not doing well or something like that, or say it had to do with like feeding them antibiotics. Do you find that there is any conflict between your inspection duties and your, animal welfare veterinarian hat, if you see what I mean?
No. It's very important for me that I may have my own personal views, but in my job, the only thing I am allowed to demand is what's in the regulations and in the law.
Right.
So, I can always, in other ways try and change the law, but it is a challenging thing to have that role where you can see things that you don't quite agree with the regulation, but that's what you have to relate to. I'm a public servant, and I'm doing what the legislators have decided we need to do.
Yes.
And so, yes, it's challenging, but on the other hand, there's more than enough work to be done to get, you know, producers and to be compliant with the regulations that exist.
Yes.
So there's plenty of challenges, even though sometimes I would like the law to go a little further than what it does.
Indeed. Right. That's what I was getting at. Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and that leads me to my next question, which is how much support do you get from the state when it comes to enforcing food safety and hygiene laws, say in a bigger operation like one of the pork or poultry businesses you describe? Because, you know, as we learned when you were listening to Barry Estabrook a few weeks ago with Pigtails and in other books that have come out recently, USDA inspectors are often marginalized or terminated even for doing their jobs if it has a negative impact on production. I'm thinking like specifically within a slaughterhouse, you know, when there's a USDA inspector on the line and he's watching, you know, either animal handling or he sees an animal that's maybe not, you know, completely healthy looking after slaughter, slowing down or stopping the line is becoming less and less of an option for USDA inspectors. And indeed, we have way fewer of them on the line than we used to. So does the state really support your cadre, your fellow vets and inspectors in doing your job, or is there a sort of a turning a blind eye?
You know, I sort of, when I hear those stories on your show, I think, oh, I'm very lucky compared to that, because yes, I do feel that we have support. There will always be a you know, a challenging situation between, you know, not disturbing production too much. That will always be a challenge. But I feel like there is room to make these sometimes difficult demands. I mean, there's one very good thing. I think it's good anyway. We get inspections from the European Union. Iceland is not in the European Union, but we're in the EFTA, the European Free Trade Association.
Uh-huh.
So we have the same food hygiene legislation that they have in Europe.
I see.
And we get the competent authority, the Icelandic Food and Veterinary my God, I'm missing the word.
No, the authority, agency, your agency,
is inspected. So the inspectors get inspected, and that in a way helps us a lot, because you know then we get the push to do the right things. Sometimes you know we have a lot of pressure to not stop production. There's a lot of pressure the other way.
Yes.
So this outside inspection that we're actually doing what we're supposed to do is a sort of force in the other direction.
Yeah.
You know, and they make reports, and so that is something I don't think the USDA has, and that we have.
No, we most certainly do not, my dear. And that leads me to the next question, because you just a perfect segue there, Josie. Thank you. Because you talked about the pressure for not stopping production. So in our country, the food industry, whether it's the animal livestock industry, these external industries often attempt to change or influence laws or regulations at a legislative level. And I'm wondering if you have experienced the same thing in Iceland. And I think you've answered my question by saying that the EU inspects your inspectors. But do you feel like that there is a push within animal livestock industries to maybe alter those protocols, even within the EU inspection services?
The animal welfare legislation is not EU, or just a very small part of it. So I think anything that has to do with food hygiene, the industry here sort of realizes it's too too small to change. It's maybe more sometimes a push to come out of the deal or this trade association.
But, oh, really?
But there is definitely a push to influence these animal welfare law and or regulations, definitely, which is of course understandable. I mean, better animal welfare is more expensive, and they are worried that when their products get more expensive, people are going to buy less of them. So it's completely understandable. But what I do feel is a difference is I feel like it's a little more balanced, this lobbying, that the animal welfare organizations, have a maybe more equal influence than what I have a feeling it is in the U.S. I mean, like when they were going to make these, we recently got new regulations for the animal welfare in the different species, and in creating these regulations, they had one veterinarian from the Food and Veterinary Authority. There was one representative from the livestock industry, and there was one representative from an animal welfare organization who made the outline for the regulations. And then, of course, there's a lot of lobbying going on,
Yeah. But those three entities came together and they wrote the regulations.
Came together to make a draft.
Yeah. Because I'm not an expert, but I think that what happens here is more like the trade industry groups get together, possibly with vets. And I'm not aware that they include necessarily, unless under great duress, any animal welfare specialists or organizations, although it has been known to happen. I mean, certainly the U.S. poultry industry, when it came to egg layers, they passed some regulations along with the Humane Society of the United States. They helped write those regulations. But that is definitely the exception, not the rule, to how we do business here. So, you know, it's interesting to me because it's hard to say whether this happens because and there is no government support, by the way, our senators, our Congress is basically bought and paid for by, lobbyists. And idea that we have a free and democratic society is a chimera now. I mean, it just doesn't really exist anymore, in my opinion. And certainly where it comes to food legislation and legislation around industry, industry writes their own rules, and then they pay Congress by helping them get reelected. Mm-hmm. And then Congress passes the rules that the industry wants. And that's just kind of how it works around here.
Listening to your show has really made me love the European Union. I'm like,
right?
I'm so proud of the European Union compared to what's going on in the U.S.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, it's scandalous what happens here. It really is. And, and we all kind of like eat our, cheap meat and say thank you very much. I mean,
enormous amounts of cheap meat.
Yeah. As much as you want. Have some more. Here, have a double-sized portion. Eat bigger portions. Yeah. Anyway.
I think I just heard this. I think I saw a show on BBC about meat consumption. And I think the average American consumes 120 kilos of meat.
Oh, yeah. I think it's easily that.
Average European consumes 80 kilos of meat.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah.
It's quite a difference. Mm-hmm. And if you think about it, we have a fairly large vegetarian population here. I mean, I know it's not huge, but so that means that some people are eating way more than 120 kilos. I mean, but anyway, Josie, stay on the line. We're going to take a short break for a sponsor drop, and we'll be right back with Dr. Lista, a veterinarian from Iceland who is helping to school us on how things go in the EU. Stay tuned.
This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery, calling in from Spring Mountain above the Napa Valley. Thank you for listening to this show. In our industrial world of highly processed food and wine, we support the values of Heritage Radio Network. All of us at Kane encourage you to seek out individuality and beauty in everything you eat and drink. To learn more about us, go to kane5.com.
We're back. This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. My guest today is Dr. Flora Josephine Hagen-Lista, who is a veterinarian in Iceland and a listener. And I'm proud to have her on the show to talk a little bit about practices in Europe, about which we really hardly ever hear. I mean, you really have to look hard on the internet to read about what's, I guess, harder than I'm willing to look, mostly because I'm so horrified by what's happening here. I can't stop reading this. but anyway, it is absolutely fascinating. So let's talk a little bit about medications, because as a vet, you know all about that. So you prescribe medications for livestock. And I'm just curious, you know, as you know, there's a tremendous controversy, not only in the United States, but globally, about the use of antibiotics in livestock production, mostly for growth promoting, but also as it's, you know, sort of flip side disease prevention, which pretty much allows for the same status quo. But how do you guys measure how much antibiotics go into your livestock production? How carefully monitored is that, especially antibiotics used in human medicine as well? Do you have like a system there? Yeah.
Well, we have this European legislation again, and I wanted to read it for you, what it says here in our legislation. It says, food business operators rearing animals or producing primary products of animal origin are, in particular, to keep records on veterinary medicinal products or other treatments administered to the animals, dates of administration and withdrawal periods. So it means basically everybody who's keeping animals that are meant to produce, you know, meat, eggs or milk, they have to keep records about everything they use.
Yeah.
And also, from what I gather, the regulation also requires retailers to keep records for 5 years about, you know, everything they sell. So, and records that are available to the competent authorities. So, you know, I recently actually in February went on a training course for veterinarians who are working in the competent authorities in the European Union in Ireland. On, you know, specifically this, just a whole week of how to inspect farms and all the monitoring programs which we do in taking samples of the products. So yeah, so all the farmers are required to keep records. And recently, in there was published a report, or you know, recently, maybe a year ago, year and a half ago, on where they, you know, put together all the information on the usage of antibiotics in Europe, and I think Norway came out top of the class, you know, or with
your home country,
smallest, my home country, yes, and Iceland was number two.
Wow.
So
in terms of keeping records, careful monitoring.
No, and in terms of not using.
Of just not using.
You know, in terms of not using, So also, I know, you know, we, in Norway and in Iceland too, there's a database where all the vets are supposed to put in the, in all the drugs that they use for food-producing animals. And which I have access to, so, you know, I can go and check on any farm,
right?
You know, which treatments have been given.
Oh, wow. You know, I don't think we have that kind of database.
No,
I know
and,
that there is,
so,
There has to be some way. I mean, there are all these statistics in this country about 80% of the antibiotics produced in this country going to livestock.
Yeah, I was just wondering,
blah, blah, blah.
Where do you get those statistics from?
I think they get it.
Something somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. I think they get that literally from the pharmaceutical agencies, which are obliged to disclose how many pounds they produce and where those are sold into. I think where we fall down is in monitoring how much each particular farm is using of what.
Right.
And a lot of our antibiotics are administered in feed and water so that the animals are protected because of the environments in which they live, you know, being sort of not the best for animal husbandry.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but for that, and I also know that they must withdraw the antibiotics 120 days before slaughter in the case of beef cattle. I'm not sure what the limits are for other animals, but.
Yeah.
So there are some monitoring mechanisms in place, but the reality is that we have very little idea of what really and truly is being used and how much of what, especially the human class of drugs, though they have taken cephalosporins out of the mix and they've taken some of the other, more important ones. But, the tetracyclines are still heavily used. Penicillin is still heavily used. And these are it's an outrage, we don't have
in the European Union food legislation, traceability is a key concept. So you're supposed to be able to trace back what was put into each animal, feed and
water
and drugs. You're supposed to be able to, if something comes up, you're supposed to be able to trace back and figure out what happened.
So that leads me to my next question, which I don't think I put on my little question and answer thing for you. But in this country, we have a lot of new antibiotic resistant drugs, such as Salmonella Heidelberg, Salmonella Tymphorium. Mm-hmm. These are all directly attributable to antibiotic use in the livestock sector. Do you find that the European Union is developing new strains of antibiotic-resistant drugs besides MRSA, which we're going to talk about in a minute? But, do you have these new developments of E. coli 0157H7, which is antibiotic-resistant to a certain extent? I mean, how has your use of antibiotics changed your pathogen field, as it were?
I'm not entirely aware of. I'm just trying to. It's definitely a problem. I just can't quite remember which pathogens. I'm sorry. I'm at a loss at that.
No worries.
Question.
We'll move on. Not a problem. I threw that at you out of the blue. So not fair. Let's talk about Denmark for a minute, though, because the Denmark pork production has been held up as alternatively the poster child for how successful farmers have been in ridding human antibiotics or even prophylactic use of antibiotics in their pigs.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the same time, in our country, the pork industry in Denmark is vilified because they had a little spike in mortality after they did that. And the pork industry in this country is bound and determined to insist that this just did not work. The Danish experiment, as it's called, has been written up as the worst thing that ever happened to pork. But clearly that is not true. And so what else are the Danes doing in terms of pork husbandry that allow them to have such a thriving pork industry without the use of antibiotics? Is there a difference in the way they generally raise their pigs from what we do?
I think they're very good at biosecurity, for sure. There are differences. I don't know whether those differences are what makes them, succeed at not using antibiotics. I think they just succeed at not using antibiotics because, I don't know. I feel like maybe I'm wrong, but it feels like the American system. They've just gotten so used to using it, they just think they can't do without it. But it's pretty intensive, the Danish system, too, you know. But,
yes.
Of course, they follow European legislation, which now says that you have to have the sows group housed, not in gestation pens,
right.
Except for a period of 30 days.
Uh-huh.
And the Danes are actually banning that period of gestation crates, too. So now I think they can only have them in crates when they are in the farrowing pens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, when they have the piglets.
Yeah.
They also have minimum space requirements. I don't know, you know, they have to have a certain amount of square meters, 0.65 per fattening pig, between 80 and 110 kilos.
Uh-huh.
I don't know whether the stocking density is greater in the U.S. That might be a factor.
It might be.
True.
Certainly,
I don't know. I can't really imagine it being a lot, you know, tighter than that, but...
I don't think you've seen an American farm, honey.
So,
you know how we work here.
and you know, then they have these requirements for rooting material, which they are, you know, I know in Denmark they're trying to do this with wood.
Right.
So which can be discussed whether that's, you know,
whether that's actually effective or not. Well, I mean, the point is that they're trying to do something to make the pigs happier in spite of the fact that they're confined
absolutely.
In these terrible places.
Absolutely, you know, anything that's. So, and just getting rid of those gestation crates is a, you know, big step.
That was huge. I mean, in this country, we are phasing them out as well because a lot of our big pork buyers have said that they will not buy pork from companies that sell, that use gestation or farrowing crates for pigs. And so those are being phased out, but it's taking, you know, because it's really basically they're waiting until that they would have had to replace them. If you know what I mean, you know, like they're still using them.
Right, they're just waiting for their
lifespan to
expire or the crates, right?
And then they'll make the you know, the infrastructural changes. And it sounds like the Danes kind of didn't take that step. They just said, "Okay, you're done with these crates. Get rid of them." How did that happen with the farmers? I know I'm sending you another question that you're not really prepared for, but how did farmers deal
Denmark?
With that? Yeah.
You know, I think I'm just going to answer the question in Norway instead because that's what
fine.
I know the answer to.
Okay.
Because there they actually the industry itself banned gestation crates in the year 2000.
Wow.
I mean the Danes always laugh at the Norwegians when we talk about pork production, you know. So they think they're sort of pitifully small and state subsidized, but still I've got to tell the story anyway that, you know, when I started vet school in 2000 and I never seen a sow in a gestation crate.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was shocked when I saw it the first time, you know, here. So it was the industry itself had the initiative to stop the gestation crates in the year 2000. Another story about that is when I went to another one of my training courses for veterinary inspectors in Parma, ironically enough, on animal welfare in pig production.
Nice.
isn't that funny?
It's lovely.
So there I met this French inspector, and he told me, you know, it was supposed to be phased out or by the 2013, the gestation crates in Europe.
Yeah.
And he said in 2012, you know, there was none of the pig producers in his district who'd done it.
Oh, dear.
And France got this letter from the European Union saying, you know, if you don't fix this within a year, we're going to give you a huge fine, you know. And the authorities, I guess, got in touch with the pig producers and informed them of the situation. And within 1 year, I mean, they had 10 years to to do the change. They hadn't done the thing. Within 1 year, 95%
wow.
of the producers were compliant.
Wow. And so that
and,
is...
And the whole time, they, you know, I'm sure they'd been saying stuff like, oh, it's not possible, it's too expensive, it's not doable, we can't do it.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah. And yet when so confronted with a greater
really good,
loss...
and describing story about...
It is.
You know, when one can, it's possible to do whatever if there's the will to do it.
Yes. But that leads me to the question of whether or not the state is involved at all in, you know, in subsidizing these industries or making it somehow easier mm-hmm. for them to make a mm-hmm. major infrastructural change like that, which that would mm-hmm. not happen in this country. Perhaps it does happen
no.
in Norway or in the EU somewhere.
Yeah.
No?
Yeah, it does to a varying degree in different countries, but there is some support,
uh-huh.
which there's not here in Iceland for the pig industry, which is making it a little hard for them.
Interesting. We're going to yeah. jump ahead a little bit here and talk just for a second, because you mentioned in one of our correspondences that the Icelandic poultry industry has methods for controlling Salmonella and Campylobacter so mm-hmm. that it is a significantly less problem of a problem in terms of foodborne illness. And whereas here, it's those two pathogens are the number one and two causes of foodborne illness in this country. So mm-hmm. what are you guys mm-hmm. doing there that we need to learn from you?
Well, I don't know if you want to learn it, but I'm going to tell you what we do anyway. Concerning Salmonella, we have there's taken samples from all flocks of birds or broilers.
Yeah.
Within 3 weeks of slaughter. And if they are positive for Salmonella, they are not allowed to slaughter them.
Oh.
So, which means they're actually just put down on the farm. You know, they
wow.
put gas in the barn. So
wow.
every flock is sampled. Every single flock is sampled. And if there is Salmonella, they you know, get put down, and they do not go on market.
Wow.
And they also take samples, you know, even if you had a negative sample on the farm,
uh-huh.
they also take samples in the slaughterhouse.
Right.
And if that sample is positive, then they have to recall all of the poultry.
That's incredible.
And they have to heat treat it. Then uh-huh. they can sell it. If they heat treat it.
Right. So they cook it, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cook it.
Mm-hmm. That's incredible,
that's
right. Josie.
Incredible?
You have
yeah,
a zero
really,
tolerance
yeah.
for Salmonella and Campylobacter. I mean, if that will never, ever happen in this country.
We have something else for Campylobacter. I'll tell you about that.
Okay.
But this is, in Norway, Sweden, and Finland, they have also very low, they have very little Salmonella. They don't, by law, it's not that you can't slaughter Salmonella flocks, but no one would do it. The slaughterhouses don't want Salmonella. So,
yeah.
you know, very, very rarely do they find Salmonella on the farm.
So incredible.
So, and Campylobacter, what happened was there was a big outbreak in Iceland, or big, relatively big anyway, of Campylobacter in humans in 1999.
Uh-huh.
And as a result, they made a regulation where they test all flocks 5 days before they go to slaughter.
Yeah.
And if they are positive, then they have to either freeze or heat treat the chicken.
Wow.
Before it goes on market.
Uh-huh. Wow.
So, yeah. And this is something that they've been very successful at. The value of the chicken goes down with freezing it and not having it fresh.
Yeah.
It's a very strong incentive for the farmers to get the Campylobacter down.
Oh yeah. Well, both of these. I mean, the idea that
Purdue. The other thing too, of course, it's
yeah.
terrible. It's very expensive for a farmer to, you know, they don't only lose their whole barn of 10,000 chickens. They also have to pay a lot of money to put them down, you know.
Yes, and then dispose of them, right?
Dispose of them and get all the gas. It's a big thing, you know.
Yeah, very big thing. Huge. Yeah. I mean, in this country, absolutely unthinkable that Purdue, Tyson, or any of the other big producers would countenance anything like this. And we have, as a result, an unbelievably high incidence of salmonella, obviously on farm, because it's then going into slaughterhouses. And I'm sure you saw a few years ago when Cargill, which is one of our, you know, big meat producers, they're a big turkey business, and they had salmonella Heidelberg in one of their plants, and people got very sick. They did do a recall, to their credit, which a lot of companies won't do a recall, but they did a recall. Cargill is pretty good when it comes to these kinds of issues, and then eventually they could not clean the plant sufficiently, and eventually they had to shut it down, and that was the end of that plant. I mean, it was like because they could not find the source of it, and they could not get the place clean enough. So, I mean,
it can be really hard to get rid of the salmonella.
Absolutely.
Really difficult.
Well, sadly, my darling, we have only but 1 minute, and I just want to take that moment to say thank you so, so much for joining me today. This has really been a pleasure, and I would love to do like a regular visit with you. I hope you will be amenable to that. But I think
that would be fun.
I think it would be really fun. I mean, we'll both perhaps we could work together on shows like to talk to sort of compare and contrast numbers and about EU protocols versus American protocols. I'll try to be more informed. And I know you have access to lots of stuff that I probably would never have. But this has just been fascinating for me. I mean, you just blew my mind with the story about how they fixed salmonella in your country. It's like, whoa, incredible. So you will come back. And again, this was my new best friend, Flora Josephine Hagen-Liste. Am I saying your name right? How do you say it in Norwegian? What's your native tongue, by the way?
Josie. The Norwegian way of saying Josie.
Yeah.
So I'm just called Josie, so.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that was a good way, the way you said it.
Okay, good. I'm glad I got it right. Thank you very much, my darling. And keep talking to me. Keep sending me stuff. I read every single thing you sent me, all those articles. Very interesting. I'd love to talk about MRSA and Danish farms, by the way, the next time. We'll make time for that.
Yeah.
Okay, darling. Yeah. Thank you so much. Enjoy the rest of your day. And thanks to my sponsor, Kane Winery, and to my engineer, Jack, as always. See you next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.